There are some old stories about the Tolnedrin campaign in Meregor, Belgarath, Sok remarked. Rumors have been floating around for years that some of the Legion commanders sold their prisoners to the Naesan slavers, instead of killing them. It is the sort of thing a Tolnedrin would do.
It's a possibility, I suppose, Belgarath replied, frowning.
Do we have to stay here?
Rog demanded harshly. His back was still turned, and there was a rigidity to it that spoke his outrage loudly.
Why is he angry with me?
Taiba asked, her voice dropping wearily from her lips and scarcely more than a whisper.
Cover your nakedness, woman, Rog told her. You are an affront to decent eyes.
Is that all?
She laughed, a rich, throaty sound.
These are all the clothes that I have.
She looked down at her lush figure.
Besides, there is nothing wrong with my body. It is not deformed or ugly. Why should I hide it?
Lewd woman, Rog accused her.
If it bothers you so much, don't look,
she suggested.
Relg has a certain religious problem, Silk told her dryly.
Oh, do not mention religion,
she said with a shudder.
You'll see, Rog snorted. She is completely depraved. Not exactly, Belgarath told him. In Rachthor, the word religion means the altar and the knife.
Geryon,
Aunt Paul said,
give me your cloak.
He unfastened his heavy wool cloak and handed it to her. She started to cover the exhausted slave woman with it, but stopped suddenly and looked closely at her.
Where are your children? The Murkos took them,
Timer replied in a dead voice.
They were two baby girls, very beautiful, but they are gone now. We'll get them back for you,
Geryon promised impulsively. She gave a bitter little laugh.
I don't think so. The Murkos gave them to the Grolems, and the Grolems sacrificed them on the altar of Torak. Tuchek himself held the knife.
Geryon felt his blood running cold.
His cloak is warm,
Taiba said gratefully, her hands smoothing the rough cloth.
I have been cold for such a long time,
she sighed with a sort of weary contentment. Belgarath and Aunt Paul were looking at each other across Taiba's body.
I must be doing something right, the old man remarked cryptically after a moment, to stumble across her like this after all of these years of searching.
Are you sure that she's the right one, Father?
She almost has to be. Everything fits together too well, right down to the last detail.
He drew in a deep breath and then let it out explosively.
That's been worrying me for 1,000 years.
He suddenly looked enormously pleased with himself.
How did you escape from the slave pens, Taiba?
One of the Murkos forgot to lock a door, she replied, her voice drowsy. After I slipped out, I found this knife. I was going to try to find Tuchik and kill him with it, but I got lost. There are so many caves down here, so many. I wish I could kill him before I die, but I don't suppose there is much hope for that now.
She sighed regretfully.
I think that I would like to sleep for now. I am so very tired.
Will you be all right here? Aunt Paul asked her. We have to leave, but we will be back. Do you need anything?
A little light, maybe,
Taiba sighed.
I have lived in the dark all of my life. I think I'd like it to be light when I die.
Relg, Aunt Paul said, make her some light.
We might need it ourselves.
His voice was still stiffly offended. She needs it more.
Do it, Relg,
Belgarath told the zealot in a firm voice. Relg's face hardened, but he mixed some of the contents of his two pouches together on a flat stone and dribbled a bit of water onto the mixture. The pasty substance began to glow.
Thank you,
Taiba said simply.
Relg refused to answer her, or to even look in her direction. They went back up the passageway, leaving her beside the small pool with her dim little light. She began to sing again, quite softly this time, and in a voice near the edge of sleep. Relg led them through the dark galleries, twisting and changing course frequently, always climbing. Hours dragged by, though time had little meaning in this perpetual darkness. They climbed more of the sheer faces and followed the passageway, that wound higher and higher up into the vast rock pillar. Geryon lost track of direction as they climbed and found himself wondering if even Relg knew which way he was going. As they rounded another corner in another gallery, a faint breeze seemed to touch their faces. The breeze carried a dreadful odor with it.
"What is that stink?"
Silk asked, wrinkling his sharp nose.
"The slave pens, most likely,"
Belgarath replied.
"Merigals are lax about sanitation."
"Lupians are on the rocks toll, aren't they?"
Barak asked. Belgarath nodded.
"And they open up into the city itself? As I remember it, they do." "You have done it, Relg,"
Barak said, clapping the Ulgo on the shoulder.
"Don't touch me,"
Relg told him.
"Sorry, Relg. The slave pens are going to be guarded,"
Belgarath told them.
"We'll want to be very quiet now."
They crept on up the passageway, being careful where they put their feet. Geryon was not certain at what point the gallery began to show evidence of human construction. Finally, they passed a partially open iron door.
"Is there anybody in there?"
he whispered to Silk. The little man sidled up to the opening, his dagger held low and ready. He glanced in, his head making a quick, darting movement.
"Just some bones,"
he reported somberly. Belgarath signaled for a halt.
"These lower galleries have probably been abandoned,"
he told them in a very quiet voice.
"After the causeway was finished, the Mergos didn't need all of those thousands of slaves. We'll go on up, but be quiet and keep your eyes open."
They padded silently up the gradual incline of the gallery, passing more of the rusting iron doors, all standing partially ajar. At the top of the slope, the gallery turned back sharply on itself, still angling upward. Some words were crudely lettered on the wall in a script Geryon could not recognize.
"Grandfather,"
he whispered, pointing at the words. Belgarath glanced at the lettering and grunted.
"Ninth level,"
he muttered.
"We are still some distance below the city."
"How far do we go before we start running into Mergos?"
Barak rumbled, looking around with his hand on his sword hilt. Belgarath shrugged slightly.
"It's hard to say. I'd guess that only the top two or three levels are occupied."
They followed the gallery upward until it turned sharply, and once again there were words written on the wall in the alien script.
"Eighth level," Belgarath translated. "Keep going."
The smell of the slave pens grew stronger as they progressed upward through the succeeding levels.
"There's light ahead,"
Durnik warned sharply, just before they turned the corner to enter the fourth level.
"Wait here,"
Silk breathed, and melted around the corner, his dagger held close against his leg. The light was dim and seemed to be bobbing slightly, growing gradually brighter as the moments dragged by.
"Someone with a torch,"
Barak muttered. The torchlight suddenly flickered, throwing gyrating shadows. Then it grew steady, no longer bobbing. After a few moments, Silk came back, carefully wiping his dagger.
"A Mergo," he told them. "I think he was looking for something. The cells up there are still empty."
"What did you do with him?"
"I dragged him into one of the cells. They won't stumble over him, unless they are looking for him."
Relg was carefully veiling his eyes.
"Even that little bit of light?" Durnik asked him.
"It is the color of it," Relg explained.
They rounded the corner into the fourth level and started up again. 100 yards up the gallery, a torch was stuck into a crack in the wall, burning steadily. As they approached it, they could see a long smear of fresh blood on the uneven, littered floor. Belgarath stopped outside of the cell door, scratching at his beard.
What was he wearing?
He asked Silk.
One of those hooded robes, Silk replied.
Why?
Go get it.
Silk looked at him briefly, then nodded. He went back into the cell and came out a moment later, carrying a black Murgle robe. He handed it to the old man.
Belgarath held up the robe, looking critically at the long cut running up the back.
Try not to put such big holes in the rest of them, he told the little man.
Silk grinned at him.
Sorry. I guess I got a bit over-enthusiastic. I will be more careful from now on.
He glanced at Barak.
Care to join me? He invited.
Naturally. Coming, Mander Allen?
The knight nodded gravely, loosening his sword in its sheath.
We'll wait here, then,
Belgarath told them.
Be careful. But don't take any longer than you have to.
The three men moved stealthily on up the gallery toward the third level.
Can you guess at the time, Father?
Aunt Paul asked quietly, after they had disappeared.
Several hours after midnight.
Will we have enough time left before dawn?
If we hurry.
Maybe we should wait out the day here, and go up when it gets dark again.
He frowned.
I don't think so, Paul. Tuchik's up to something. He knows I'm coming. I have felt that for the last week. But he has not made a move of his own yet. Let's not give him any more time than we have to.
He's going to fight you, Father.
It's long overdue anyway. Tuchik and I have been stepping around each other for thousands of years, because the time was never just exactly right. Now, it's finally come down to this.
He looked off into the darkness, his face bleak.
When it starts. I want you to stay out of it, Paul.
She looked at the grim-faced old man for a long moment, then nodded.
Whatever you say, Father,
she said. Chapter 26 The Murgle robe was made of coarse black cloth, and it had a strange emblem woven into the fabric just over Garion's heart. It smelled of smoke and of something else even more unpleasant. There was a small ragged hole in the robe just under the left armpit, and the cloth around the hole was wet and sticky. Garion's skin cringed away from that wetness. They were moving rapidly up through the galleries of the last three levels of the slave pens with the deep cowled hoods of the Murgle robes hiding their faces. Though the galleries were lighted by sooty torches, they encountered no guards, and the slaves locked behind the pitted iron doors made no sound as they passed. Garion could feel the dreadful fear behind those doors.
How do we get up in the city? Durnick whispered.
There's a stairway. At the upper end of the top gallery, Silk replied softly.
Is it guarded?
Not anymore.
An iron-barred gate, chained and locked, blocked the top of the stairway, but Silk bent and drew a slim metal implement from one boot, probed inside the lock for a few seconds, then grunted with satisfaction as the lock clicked open in his hand.
I will have a look, he whispered, and slipped out.
Beyond the gate, Garion could see the stars and, outlined against them, the looming buildings of Rachthal. A scream, agonizing and despairing, echoed through the city, followed after a moment by the hollow sound of some unimaginably huge iron gong. Garion shuddered.
A few moments later, Silk slipped back through the gate. There doesn't seem to be anybody about, he murmured softly. Which way do we go?
Belgarath pointed.
That way. We'll go along the wall to the temple.
The temple?
Relg asked sharply.
We have to go through it to get to Tuchik, the old man replied. We're going to have to hurry. Morning is not far off.
Rachthal was not like other cities. The vast buildings had little of that separateness that they had had in other places. It was as if the Murgos and Grolems who lived here had no sense of personal possession, so their structures lacked that insularity of individual property to be found among the houses in the cities of the West. There were no streets in the ordinary sense of the word, but rather interconnecting courtyards and corridors that passed between and quite often through the buildings. The city seemed deserted as they crept silently through the dark courtyards and shadowy corridors, yet there was a kind of menacing watchfulness about the looming, silent black walls around them. Peculiar-looking turrets jutted from the walls in unexpected places, leaning out over the courtyards, brooding down at them as they passed. Narrow windows stared accusingly at them, and the arched doorways were filled with lurking shadows. An oppressive air of ancient evil lay heavily on Rakhtal, and the stones themselves seemed almost to gloat as Geryon and his friends moved deeper and deeper into the dark maze of the Grolem Fortress.
"Are you sure that you know where you're going?"
Barak whispered nervously to Belgarath.
"I have been here before,"
the old man told him quietly.
"I like to keep an eye on Turchik from time to time. We go up those stairs. They will take us to the top of the city wall."
The stairway was narrow and steep, with massive walls on either side and a vaulted roof overhead. The stone steps were worn by centuries of use. They climbed silently. Another scream echoed through the city, and the huge gong sounded an iron note once more. When they emerged from the stairway, they were atop the outer wall. It was as broad as a highway, and encircled the entire city. A parapet ran along its outer edge, marking the brink of the dreadful precipice that dropped away to the floor of the rocky wasteland a mile or more below. Once they emerged from the shelter of the buildings, the chill air bit at them, and the black flagstones and rough-hewn blocks of the outer parapet glittered with frost in the icy starlight. Belgarath looked out at the open stretch lying along the top of the wall ahead of them, and at the shadowy buildings looming several hundred yards ahead.
"We had better spread out," he whispered. "Too many people in one place attract attention in Rakhtal. We'll go across here two at a time. Walk. Don't run or crouch down. Try to look as if you belong here. Let's go."
He started along the top of the wall with Barak at his side, the two of them walking purposefully, but not appearing to hurry. After a few moments, Aunt Paul and Mandaralan followed. Silk whispered, "Danik, Geryon and I will go next. You and Relg follow in a minute or so." He peered at Relg's face, shadowed beneath the Murgo hood. "Are you all right?"
"As long as I don't look up at the sky," Relg answered tightly. His voice sounded as if it were coming from between clenched teeth.
"Come along, then, Geryon," Silk murmured. It required every ounce of Geryon's self-control to walk at a normal pace across the frosty stones. It seemed somehow that eyes watched from every shadowy building and tower as he and the little Drasnian crossed the open section atop the wall. The air was a dead calm and bitterly cold, and the stone blocks of the outer parapet were covered with a lacy filigree of rime frost. There was another scream from the temple lying somewhere ahead. The corner of a large tower jutted out at the end of the open stretch of wall, obscuring the walkway beyond. "Wait here a moment," Silk whispered, as they stepped gratefully into its shadow, and he slipped around the jutting corner. Geryon stood in the icy dark, straining his ears for any sound. He glanced once toward the parapet. Far out on the desolate wasteland below, a small fire was burning. It twinkled in the dark like a small red star. He tried to imagine how far away it might be. Then there was a light scraping sound somewhere above him. He spun quickly, his hand going to his sword. A shadowy figure dropped from a ledge on the side of the tower several yards over his head and landed with cat-like silence on the flagstones directly in front of him. Geryon caught a familiar, sour, acid reek of stale perspiration.
"It's been a long time, hasn't it, Geryon?"
Brill said quietly, with an ugly chuckle. "Stay back," Geryon warned, holding his sword with its point low as Barak had taught him.
"I knew that I'd catch you alone someday," Brill said, ignoring the sword.
He spread his hands wide and crouched slightly, his cast eye gleaming in the starlight. Geryon backed away, waving his sword threateningly. Brill bounded to one side, and Geryon instinctively followed him with the sword point. Then, so fast that Geryon could not follow, Brill dodged back and struck his hand down sharply on the boy's forearm. Geryon's sword skittered away across the icy flagstones. Desperately, Geryon reached for his dagger. Then, another shadow flickered in the darkness at the corner of the tower. Brill grunted as a foot caught him solidly in the side. He fell, but rolled quickly across the stones and came back up on his feet, his stance wide and his hands moving slowly in the air in front of him. Silk dropped his Murgle robe behind him, kicked it out of his way, and crouched with his hands also spread wide. Brill grinned.
"I should have known you are around somewhere, Keldar."
"I suppose I should have expected you to, Kordok," Silk replied. "You always seem to show up." Brill flicked a quick hand toward Silk's face, but the little man easily avoided it. "How do you keep getting ahead of us?" he asked almost conversationally. "That's a habit of yours that is starting to irritate Belgarath." He launched a quick kick at Brill's groin, but the cast-eyed man jumped back. Brill laughed shortly.
"You people are too tender-hearted with horses. I've had to ride quite a few of them to death chasing you. How did you get out of that pit?" He sounded interested. "Tar Ogos was furious the next morning."
"Oh, what a shame.
He had the guards flayed."
"I imagine the Murgo looks a bit peculiar without his skin." Brill dove forward suddenly, both hands extended, but Silk sidestepped the lunge and smashed his hand sharply down in the middle of Brill's back. Brill grunted again, but rolled clear, farther out on the stones atop the wall.
"You might be just as good as they say," he admitted grudgingly.
"Try me, Kordok," Silk invited with a nasty grin. He moved out from the wall of the tower, his hands in constant motion. Geryon watched the two circling each other with his heart in his mouth. Brill jumped again, with both feet lashing out, but Silk dove under him. They both rolled to their feet again. Silk's left hand flashed out, even as he came to his feet, catching Brill high on the head. Brill reeled from the blow, but managed to kick Silk's knee as he spun away.
"Your technique is defensive, Keldar," he grated, shaking his head to clear the effects of Silk's blow. "That is a weakness."
"Just a difference of style, Kordok," Silk replied. Brill drove a gouging thumb at Silk's eye, but Silk blocked it and slammed a quick counterblow to the pit of his enemy's stomach. Brill scissored his legs as he fell, sweeping Silk's legs out from under him. Both men tumbled across the frosty stones and sprang to their feet again, their hands flickering blows faster than Geryon's eyes could follow them. The mistake was a simple one, so slight that Geryon could not even be sure it was a mistake. Brill flicked a jab at Silk's face that was an ounce or two harder than it should have been, and traveled no more than a fraction of an inch too far. Silk's hands flashed up and caught his opponent's wrist with a deadly grip, and he rolled backward toward the parapet, his legs coiling, even as the two of them fell. Jerked off balance, Brill seemed almost to dive forward. Silk's legs straightened suddenly, launching the cast-eyed man up and forward with a tremendous heave. With a strangled exclamation, Brill clutched desperately at one of the stone blocks of the parapet as he sailed over, but he was too high, and his momentum was too great. He hurtled over the parapet, plunging out and down into the darkness below the wall. His scream faded horribly as he fell, lost in the sound of yet another shriek from the Temple of Torak. Silk rose to his feet, glanced once over the edge, and then came back to where Geryon stood trembling in the shadows by the tower wall.
"Silk!"
Geryon exclaimed, catching the little man's arm in relief.
"What was that?" Belgarath asked, coming back around the corner.
"Brill," Silk replied blandly, pulling his Murgo robe back on.
"Again?" Belgarath demanded with exasperation. "What was he doing this time?"
"Trying to fly, last time I saw him," Silk smirked. The old man looked puzzled. "He wasn't doing it very well," Silk added.
Belgarath shrugged. "Maybe it'll come to him in time."
"He doesn't really have all that much time." Silk glanced out over the edge. From far below, terribly far below. There came a faint, muffled crash. Then, after several seconds, another.
"Does bouncing count?" Silk asked.
Belgareth made a wry face.
"Not really."
"Then I'd say that he did not learn in time," Silk said blithely.
He looked around with a broad smile.
"What a beautiful night this is," he remarked to no one in particular.
"Let's move along," Belgareth suggested, throwing a quick, nervous glance at the eastern horizon. "It will start to lighten up over there any time now."
They joined the others in the deep shadows beside the high wall of the temple some 100 yards down the wall, and they waited tensely for Relg and Durnik to catch up.
"What kept you?"
Barak whispered as they waited.
"I met an old friend of ours," Silk replied quietly.
His grin was a flash of white teeth in the shadows.
"It was Brill,"
Geryon told the rest of them in a hoarse whisper.
"He and Silk fought with each other, and Silk threw him over the edge."
Mandaralan glanced toward the frosty parapet.
"'Tis a goodly way down," he observed.
"Isn't it, though?" Silk agreed. Barak chuckled and put his big hand wordlessly on Silk's shoulder. Then Durnik and Relg came along the top of the wall to join them in the shadows.
"We have to go through the temple," Belgareth told them in a quiet voice. "Pull your hoods as far over your faces as you can. Keep your heads down. Stay in a single file and mutter to yourselves as if you were praying. If anybody speaks to us, let me do the talking, and each time the gong sounds, turn toward the altar and bow."
He led them, then, to a thick door bound with weathered iron straps. He looked back once to be sure they were all in line, then put his hand to the latch and pushed the door open. The inside of the temple glowed with a smoky red light, and a dreadful charnel house reek filled it. The door through which they entered led into a covered balcony that curved around the back of the dome of the temple. A stone balustrade ran along the edge of the balcony, with thick pillars at evenly spaced intervals. The openings between the pillars were draped with the same coarse, heavy cloth from which the Murgol robes were woven. Along the back wall of the balcony were a number of doors, set deep into the stone. Geryon surmised that the balcony was largely used by temple functionaries going to and fro on various errands. As soon as they started along the balcony, Belgareth crossed his hands on his chest and led them at a slow, measured pace, chanting in a deep, loud voice. A scream echoed up from below, piercing, filled with terror and agony. Geryon involuntarily glanced through the parted drapery toward the altar. For the rest of his life, he wished he had not. The circular walls of the temple were constructed of polished black stone, and directly behind the altar was an enormous face forged of steel and buffed to a mirror shine. The face of Torak and the original of the steel masks of the Grolems. The face was beautiful. There was no question of that. Yet there was a kind of brooding evil in it, a cruelty beyond human ability to comprehend the meaning of the word. The temple floor facing the god's image was densely packed with Murgos and Grolem priests, kneeling and chanting an unintelligible rumble in a dozen dialects. The altar stood on a raised dais directly beneath the glittering face of Torak. A smoking brazier on an iron post stood at each front corner of the blood-smeared altar, and a square pit opened in the floor immediately in front of the dais. Ugly red flames licked up out of the pit, and black oily smoke rolled from it toward the dome high above. A half-dozen Grolems in black robes and steel masks were gathered around the altar, holding the naked body of a slave. The victim was already dead, his chest gaping open like the chest of a butchered hog, and a single Grolem stood in front of the altar, facing the image of Torak with raised hands. In his right he held a long, curved knife. In his left, a dripping human heart.
"Behold our offering, dragon god of Angarak,"
he cried in a huge voice, then turned and deposited the heart in one of the smoking braziers. There was a burst of steam and smoke from the brazier, and a hideous sizzle as the heart dropped onto the burning coals. From somewhere beneath the temple floor, the huge iron gong sounded, its vibration shimmering in the air.
The assembled Murgos and their Grolem overseers groaned and pressed their faces to the floor. Geryon felt a hand nudge his shoulder. Silk, already turned, was bowing toward the bloody altar. Awkwardly, sickened by the horror below, Geryon also bowed. The six Grolems at the altar lifted the lifeless body of the slave almost contemptuously and cast it into the pit before the dais. Flames belched up and sparks rose in the thick smoke as the body fell into the fire below. A dreadful anger welled up in Geryon. Without even thinking, he began to draw in his will, fully intent upon shattering the vile altar and the cruel image hovering above it into shards and fragments in a single cataclysmic unleashing of naked force.
Dalgeryon, the voice within his mind said sharply, do not interfere. This isn't the time.
I can't stand it, Geryon raged silently. I've got to do something.
You can't. Not now. You will rouse the whole city. Unclench your will, Belgeryon.
Do as he says, Geryon. Aunt Paul's voice sounded quietly in his mind. The unspoken recognition passed between Aunt Paul's mind and that strange other mind as Geryon helplessly let the anger and will drain out of him.
This abomination won't stand much longer, Belgeryon, the voice assured him. Even now, the earth gathers to rid itself of it.
And then the voice was gone.
What are you doing up here?
A harsh voice demanded. Geryon jerked his eyes away from the hideous scene below. A masked and robed Grolem stood in front of Belgarath, blocking their way.
We are the servants of Torak,
the old man replied in an accent that perfectly matched the gutturals of Murgo's speech.
Alenrachthal are the servants of Torak, the Grolem said. You are not attending the ritual of sacrifice. Why?
We're pilgrims from Rakhaga, Belgarath explained. Only just arrived in the Dread City.
We were commanded to present ourselves to the Hierarch of Rakhaga in the instant of our arrival. That stern duty prevents our participation in the celebration.
The Grolem grunted suspiciously.
Could the revered priest of the Dragon God direct us to the chambers of our Hierarch? We are unfamiliar with the Dark Temple.
There was another shriek from below. As the iron gong boomed, the Grolem turned and bowed toward the altar. Belgarath gave a quick jerk of his head to the rest of them, turned, and also bowed.
Go to the last door but one,
the Grolem instructed, apparently satisfied by their gestures of piety.
It will lead you down to the halls of the Hierarchs.
We are endlessly grateful to the priest of the Dark God,
Belgarath thanked him, bowing. They filed past the masked Grolem, their heads down and their hands crossed on their breasts, muttering to themselves, as if in prayer.
Vile, Relg was strangling. Obscenity. Abomination.
Keep your head down, Silk whispered. There are Grolems all around us.
As Ul gives me strength, I won't rest until Rakhthal is laid waste,
Relg vowed in a fervent mutter. Belgarath had reached an ornately carved door near the end of the balcony, and he swung it open cautiously.
Is the Grolem still watching us?
He whispered to Silk. The little man glanced back at the priest standing some distance behind them.
Yes. Wait. There he goes. The balcony's clear now.
The sorcerer let the door swing shut and stepped instead to the last door on the balcony. He tugged the latch carefully, and the door opened smoothly. He frowned.
It's always been locked before,
he muttered.
Do you think it's a trap?
Barak rumbled, his hand dipping under the Murgo robe to find his sword hilt.
It is possible, but we don't have much choice.
Belgarath pulled the door open the rest of the way, and they all slipped through as another shriek came from the altar. The door slowly closed behind them as the gong shuddered the stones of the temple. They started down the worn stone steps beyond the door. The stairway was narrow and poorly lighted, and it went down sharply, curving always to the right. "'We're right up against the outer wall, aren't we?' Silk asked, touching the black stones on his left.
Belgareth nodded. "'The stairs lead down to Tuchik's private place.'
They continued down until the walls on either side changed from blocks to solid stone.
"'He lives below the city?'
Silk asked, surprised.
"'Yes,' Belgareth replied. "'He built himself a sort of hanging turret out from the rock of the peak itself.' "'Strange idea,'
Durnick said. "'Tuchik's a strange sort of person,' Aunt Paul told him grimly. Belgareth stopped them.
"'The stairs go down about 100 feet,' he whispered. "'There will be 2 guards just outside the door to the turret. "'Not even Tuchik could change that, no matter what he is planning.'
"'Sorcerers?'
Barak asked softly.
"'No.' The guards are ceremonial more than functional. They are just ordinary Grolems.
We'll rush them, then.
That won't be necessary. I can get you close enough to deal with them, but I want it to be quiet and quick.
The old man reached inside his Murgo robe and drew out a roll of parchment bound with a strip of black ribbon. He started down again with Barak and Mandaralan close behind him. The curve of the stairway brought a lighted area into view as they descended. Torches illuminated the bottom of the stone steps and a kind of antechamber hewn from the solid rock. 2 Grolem priests stood in front of a plain black door, their arms folded.
"Who approaches? The Holy of Holies,"
one of them demanded, putting his hand to his sword hilt.
"A messenger,"
Belgareth announced importantly.
"I bear a message for the master from the Hierarch of Rakloska."
He held the rolled parchment above his head.
"Approach, messenger." "Praise the name of the disciple of the dragon god of Angarak,"
Belgareth boomed, as he marched down the steps with Mandaralan and Barak flanking him. He reached the bottom of the stairs and stopped in front of the steel-masked guards.
"Thus have I performed my appointed task," he declared, holding out the parchment.
One of the guards reached for it, but Barak caught his arm in a huge fist. The big man's other hand closed swiftly about the surprised Grolem's throat. The other guard's hand flashed toward his sword hilt, but he grunted and doubled over sharply as Mandaralan thrust a long, needle-pointed poniard up into his belly. With a kind of deadly concentration, the knight twisted the hilt of the weapon, probing with the point deep inside the Grolem's body. The guard shuddered when the blade reached his heart, and collapsed with a long, gurgling sigh. Barak's massive shoulders shifted, and there was a grating crunch as the bones in the first Grolem's neck came apart in his deadly grip. The guard's feet scraped spasmodically on the stone floor, and then he went limp.
"I feel better already,"
Barak muttered, dropping the body.
"You and Mandaralan stay here," Belgareth told him. "I don't want to be disturbed once I'm inside."
"We'll see to it," Barak promised. "What about these?"
He pointed at the 2 dead guards.
"Dispose of them, Ralg,"
Belgareth said shortly to the Urgo. Silk turned his back quickly as Ralg knelt between the 2 bodies and took hold of them, 1 in each hand. There was a sort of muffled slithering as he pushed down, sinking the bodies into the stone floor.
"You left the foot sticking out,"
Barak observed in a detached tone.
"Do you have to talk about it?"
Silk demanded. Belgareth took a deep breath and put his hand to the iron door handle.
"All right," he said to them quietly. "Let's go, then."
He pushed open the door. Chapter 27 The wealth of empires lay beyond the black door. Bright yellow coins, gold beyond counting, lay in heaps on the floor. Carelessly scattered among the coins were rings, bracelets, chains, and crowns, gleaming richly. Blood-red bars from the mines of Angarak stood in stacks along the wall, interspersed here and there by open chests filled to overflowing with fist-sized diamonds that glittered like ice. A large table set in the center of the room, littered with rubies, sapphires, and emeralds as big as eggs. Ropes and strings of pearls, pink, rose-gray, and even some of jet, held back the deep crimson drapes that billowed heavily before the windows. Belgareth moved like a stalking animal, showing no sign of his age, his eyes everywhere. He ignored the riches around him and crossed the deep carpeted floor to a room filled with learning, where tightly rolled scrolls lay in racks reaching to the ceiling, and the leather backs of books marched like battalions along dark wooden shelves. The tables in the second room were covered with the curious glass apparatus of chemical experiments and strange machines of brass and iron, all cogs and wheels and pulleys and chains. In yet a third chamber stood a massive gold throne, backed by drapes of black velvet. An ermine cape lay across one arm of the throne, and a scepter with a heavy gold crown lay upon the seat. Inlaid in the polished stones of the floor was a map that depicted, so far as Geryon could tell, the entire world.
"What sort of place is this?" Durnik whispered in awe.
"Krutchek amuses himself here. He has many vices, and he likes to keep each one separate,"
Aunt Paul replied with an expression of repugnance.
"He's not down here," Belgareth muttered. "Let's go up to the next level."
He led them back the way they had come and started up a flight of stone steps that curved along the rounded wall of the turret. The room at the top of the stairs was filled with horror. A rack stood in the center of it, and whips and flails hung on the walls. Cruel implements of gleaming steel lay in orderly rows on a table near the wall. Hooks, needle-pointed spikes, dreadful things with saw edges that still had bits of bone and flesh caught between their teeth. The entire room reeked of blood.
"You and Silk go ahead, Father," Aunt Paul said. "There are things in the other rooms on this level that Geryon, Durnik, and Relg should not see."
Belgareth nodded and went through a doorway with Silk behind him. After a few moments they returned by way of another door. Silk's face looked slightly sick.
"He has some rather exotic perversions, doesn't he?"
he remarked with a shudder.
Belgareth's face was bleak. "We go up again," he said quietly. "He's on the top level. I thought he might be, but I needed to be sure."
They mounted another stairway. As they neared the top, Geryon felt a peculiar tingling glow beginning somewhere deep within him, and a sort of endless singing seemed to draw him on. The mark on the palm of his right hand burned. A black stone altar stood in the first room on the top level of the turret, and the steel image of the face of Torak brooded from the wall behind it. A gleaming knife, its hilt crusted with dried blood, lay on the altar, and the bloodstains had sunk into the very pores of the rock. Belgareth was moving quickly now, his face intent and his stride cat-like. He glanced through one door in the wall beyond the altar, shook his head, and moved on to a closed door in a far wall. He touched his fingers lightly to the wood, then nodded.
"He's in here,"
he murmured with satisfaction. He drew in a deep breath and grinned suddenly.
"I have been waiting for this for a very long time."
"Don't dawdle, Father,"
Aunt Paul told him impatiently. Her eyes were steely, and the white lock at her brow glittered like frost.
"I want you to stay out of it when we get inside, Paul,"
he reminded her.
"You too, Geryon. This is between Krutchik and me."
"All right, Father,"
Aunt Paul replied. Belgareth put out his hand and opened the door. The room beyond was plain, even bare. The stone floor was uncarpeted, and the round windows looked out into the darkness and were undraped. Simple candles burned in sconces on the walls, and a plain table stood in the center of the room. Seated at the table, with his back to the door, sat a man in a hooded black robe who seemed to be gazing into an iron cask. Geryon felt his entire body throbbing in response to what was in the cask, and the singing in his mind filled him. A little boy, with pale blonde hair, stood in front of the table, and he was also staring at the cask. He wore a smudged linen smock and dirty little shoes. Though his expression seemed devoid of all thought, there was a sweet innocence about him that caught at the heart. His eyes were blue, large, and trusting, and he was quite the most beautiful child Geryon had ever seen.
What took you so long, Delgarath?
The man at the table asked, not even bothering to turn around. His voice sounded dusty. He closed the iron box with a faint click.
I was almost beginning to worry about you.
A few minor delays, Krucik,
Belgarath replied.
I hope we didn't keep you waiting too long.
I managed to keep myself occupied. Come in. Come in, all of you.
Krucik turned to look at them. His hair and beard were a yellowed white and were very long. His face was deeply lined, and his eyes glittered in their sockets. It was a face filled with an ancient and profound evil. Cruelty and arrogance had eroded all traces of decency or humanity from it, and a towering egotism had twisted it into a perpetual sneer of contempt for every other living thing. His eyes shifted to Aunt Paul.
Palgera,
he greeted her with a mocking inclination of his head.
You are as lovely as ever. Have you come finally, then, to submit yourself to the will of my master?
His leer was vile.
No, Tuchik,
she replied coldly.
I came to see justice.
Justice?
He laughed scornfully.
There's no such thing, Palgera. The strong do what they like. The weak submit. My master has taught me that.
And his maimed face did not teach you otherwise?
The high priest's face darkened briefly, but he shrugged off his momentary irritation.
I'd offer you all a place to sit and some refreshment, perhaps.
He continued in that same dusty voice.
But you won't be staying that long, I'm afraid.
He glanced at the rest of them, his eyes noting each in turn.
Your party seems diminished, Belgarath. I hope you haven't lost any of them along the way.
They're all well, Tuchik. I am certain that they will appreciate your concern, however.
All?
Tuchik drawled.
I see the nimble thief, and the man with two lives, and the blind man. But I do not see the others. Where's the dreadful bear? And the knight protector, the horse lord and the bowman, and the ladies. Where are they, the queen of the world, and the mother of the race that died?
All well, Tuchik. All well.
How extraordinary. I was almost certain that you would have lost one or two at least by now. I admire your dedication, old man. To keep intact for all of these centuries a prophecy that would have collapsed if one single ancestor had died at the wrong time.
His eyes grew distant momentarily.
Ah, he said. I see. You left them below to stand guard. You did not have to do that, Belgarath. I left orders that we were not to be disturbed.
The High Priest's eyes stopped then on Geryon's face.
Belgarion,
he said almost politely. Despite the singing that still thrilled in his veins, Geryon felt a chill as the evil force of the High Priest's mind touched him.
You are younger than I expected.
Geryon stared defiantly at him, gathering his will to ward off any surprise move by the old man at the table.
Would you pitch your will against mine, Belgarion?
Tuchik seemed amused.
You burnt Kamdar, but he was a fool. You'll find me a bit more difficult. Tell me, boy, did you enjoy it?
No,
Garion replied, still holding himself ready.
In time, you will learn to enjoy it.
Krochik said with an evil grin,
watching your enemy writhe and shriek in your mind's grip is one of the more satisfying rewards of power.
He turned his eyes back to Belgarath.
And so, "You have come at last to destroy me," he said mockingly.
"If it comes down to that, yes. It has been a long time in coming, Krochek."
"Hasn't it, though? We are very much alike, Belgarath. I have been looking forward to this meeting almost as much as you have. Yes, we are very much alike. Under different circumstances, we might even have been friends."
"I doubt that. I am a simple man, and some of your amusements are a bit sophisticated for my taste."
"Spare me that, please. You know as well as I do that we are both beyond all restriction."
"Perhaps. But I prefer to choose my friends a bit more carefully."
"You are growing tiresome, Belgarath. Tell the others to come up."
Krochek raised one eyebrow sardonically.
"Don't you want to have them watch while you destroy me? Think of how sweet their admiration will be."
"They are fine just where they are."
"Don't be tedious. Surely you are not going to deny me the opportunity to pay homage to the Queen of the World?"
Tuchik's voice was mocking.
"I yearn to behold her exquisite perfection before you kill me."
"I doubt that she would care much for you, Krochek. I will convey your respects, however."
"I insist, Belgarath. It is a small request, easily granted. If you don't summon her, I will."
Belgarath's eyes narrowed, and then he suddenly grinned.
"So, that's it," he said softly. "I wondered why you had gone to all of the trouble to let us get through so easily."
"It doesn't really matter now, you know,"
Tuchik almost purred.
"You have made your last mistake, old man. You have brought her to Rakdol, and that's all I really needed. Your prophecy dies here and now, Belgarath, and you with it." "I would imagine."
The High Priest's eyes flashed triumphantly, and Geryon felt the evil force of Tuchik's mind reaching out, searching with a terrible purpose. Belgarath exchanged a quick look with Aunt Paul and slyly winked. Tuchik's eyes widened suddenly as his mind swept through the lower levels of his grim turret and found it empty.
"Where is she?"
he demanded wildly, in a voice that was almost a scream.
"The princess was not able to come with us,"
Belgarath replied blandly.
"She sends her apologies, though."
"You are lying, Belgarath. You would not have dared to leave her behind. There is no place in the world where she would be safe."
"Not even in the caves of Ulgo."
Tuchik's face blanched.
"Ulgo?"
he gasped.
"Poor old Tuchik," Belgarath said, shaking his head in mock regret. "You are slipping badly, I'm afraid. It wasn't a bad plan you had. But didn't it occur to you to make sure that the princess was actually with us before you let me get this close to you?"
"One of the others will do just as well,"
Tuchik asserted, his eyes blazing with fury.
"No," Belgarath disagreed. "The others are all unassailable. Zenedra's the only vulnerable one, and she is at Prolgo, under the protection of Ul himself. Oh, you can attempt that if you would like, but I would not really advise it."
"Curse you, Belgarath!"
"Why don't you just give me the orb now, Tuchik?"
Belgarath suggested.
"You know I can take it away from you if I have to."
Tuchik struggled to gain control of himself.
"Let's not be hasty, Belgarath," he said after a moment.
"What are we going to gain by destroying each other? We have Thragyaska in our possession. We could divide the world between us."
"I don't want half the world, Tuchik."
"You want it all for yourself?"
A brief, knowing smile crossed Tuchik's face.
"So did I, at first. But I will settle for half."
"Actually, I don't want any of it,"
Krychek's expression became a bit desperate.
What do you want, Belgarath?
The orb,
Belgarath replied inexorably.
Give it to me, Tuchik.
Why don't we join forces and use the orb to destroy Zadar?
Why?
You hate him as much as I do. He betrayed your master. He stole Kragyaska from you.
He betrayed himself, Tuchik. And I think that haunts him sometimes. His plan to steal the orb was clever, though.
Belgarath looked thoughtfully at the little boy standing in front of the table, his large eyes fixed on the iron cask.
I wonder where he found this child, he mused. Innocence and purity are not exactly the same thing, of course, but they are very close. It must have cost Zadar a great deal of effort to raise a total innocent. Think of all of the impulses he had to suppress.
That's why I let him do it, Krychek said.
The little blonde boy, seeming to know that they were discussing him, looked at the two old men, his eyes filled with absolute trust.
The whole point is that I still have Kragyaska, the orb, Krychek said, leaning back in his chair and laying one hand on the cask. If you try to take it, I will fight you. Neither of us knows for sure how that would turn out. Why take chances?
What good is it doing you? Even if it would submit to you, what then? Would you raise Torak and surrender it to him?
I might think about it. But Torak has been asleep for 5 centuries now, and the world has run fairly well without him. I don't imagine there's all that much point in disturbing him just yet.
Which would leave you in possession of the orb? Tuchik shrugged.
Someone has to have it. Why not me?
He was still leaning back in his chair, seeming almost completely at ease. There was no warning movement, or even a flicker of emotion across his face as he struck. It came so quickly that it was not a surge, but a blow.
And the sound of it was not the now familiar roaring in the mind, but a thunderclap.
Geryon knew that, had it been directed at him, it would have destroyed him. But it was not directed at him. It lashed instead at Belgarath. For a dreadful instant, Geryon saw his grandfather engulfed in a shadow blacker than night itself. Then the shadow shattered like a goblet of delicate crystal, scattering shards of darkness as it blew apart. Now grim-faced, Belgarath still faced his ancient enemy.
"Is that the best you can do, Krychek?"
he asked, even as his own will struck. A searing blue light suddenly surrounded the Grolem, closing in upon him, seeming to crush him with its intensity. The stout chair upon which he sat burst into chunks and splinters, as if a sudden vast weight had settled down upon it. Krychek fell among the fragments of his chair and pushed back the blue incandescence with both hands. He lurched to his feet and answered with flames. For a dreadful instant, Geryon remembered Asherak burning in the wood of the Dryads. But Belgarath brushed the fire away, and, despite his once stated assertion that the will and the word needed no gesture, he raised his hand and smashed at Krychek with lightning. The sorcerer and the magician faced each other in the center of the room, surrounded by blazing lights and waves of flame and darkness. Geryon's mind grew numb under the repeated detonations of raw energy as the two struggled. He sensed that their battle was only partially visible, and that blows were being struck which he could not see, could not even imagine. The air in the turret room seemed to crackle and hiss. Strange images appeared and vanished, flickering at the extreme limits of visibility. Vast faces, enormous hands, and things Geryon could not name. The turret itself trembled as the two dreadful old men ripped open the fabric of reality itself to grasp weapons of imagination or delusion. Without even thinking, Geryon began to gather his will, drawing his mind into focus. He had to stop it. The edges of the blows were smashing at him and at the others. Beyond thought now, Belgarath and Tuchik, consumed with their hatred for each other, were unleashing forces that could kill them all. Geryon, stay out of it! Aunt Paul told him in a voice so harsh that he could not believe it was hers.
They are at the limit. If you throw anything else into it, you will destroy them both.
She gestured sharply to the others. Get back, all of you. The air around them is alive. Fearfully, they all backed toward the rear wall of the turret room. The sorcerer and the magician stood no more than a few feet apart now, their eyes blazing and their power surging back and forth in waves. The air sizzled around them, and their robes smoked. Then Geryon's eyes fell upon the little boy. He stood watching with calm, uncomprehending eyes. He neither started nor flinched at the dreadful sounds and sights that crashed around him. Geryon tensed himself to dash forward and yank the child to safety, but at that moment the little boy turned toward the table. Quite calmly, he walked through a sudden wall of green flame that shot up in front of him. Either he did not see the fire, or he did not fear it. He reached the table, stood on his tiptoes, and, raising the lid, he put his hand into the iron cask over which Kuchik had been gloating. He lifted a round, polished gray stone out of the cask. Geryon instantly felt that strange, tingling glow again, so strong now that it was almost overwhelming, and his ears filled with the haunting song. He heard Aunt Paul gasp. Holding the gray stone in both hands like a ball, the little boy turned and walked directly toward Geryon. His eyes filled with trust and the expression on his small face confident. The polished stone reflected the flashing lights of the terrible conflict raging in the center of the room, but there was another light within it as well. Deep within it stood an intense azure glow, a light that neither flickered nor changed, a light that grew steadily stronger as the boy approached Geryon. The child stopped and raised the stone in his hands, offering it to Geryon. He smiled and spoke a single word.
Arand?
An instant image filled Geryon's mind, an image of dreadful fear. He knew that he was looking directly into the mind of Tuchik. There was a picture in Tuchik's mind, a picture of Geryon holding the glowing stone in his hand, and that picture terrified the Grolem. Geryon felt waves of fear spilling out toward him, deliberately, and quite slowly. He reached his hand toward the stone the child was offering. The mark on his right palm yearned toward the stone, and the chorus of song in his mind swelled to a mighty crescendo. Even as he stretched out his hand, he felt the sudden, unthinking animal panic in Tuchik. The Grolem's voice was a hoarse shriek.
"Be not!"
he cried out desperately, directing all of his terrible power at the stone in the little boy's hands. For a shocking instant, a deadly silence filled the turret. Even Belgarath's face, drawn by his terrible struggle, was shocked and unbelieving. The blue glow within the heart of the stone seemed to contract. Then it flared again. Tuchik, his long hair and beard disheveled, stood gaping in wide-eyed and open-mouthed horror.
"I didn't mean it," he howled. I didn't.
But a new and even more stupendous force had already entered the round room. The force flashed no light, nor did it push against Geryon's mind. It seemed instead to pull out, drawing at him, as it closed about the horrified Tuchik. The high priest of the Grolem shrieked mindlessly. Then he seemed to expand, then contract, then expand again. Cracks appeared on his face as if he had suddenly solidified into stone, and the stone was disintegrating under the awful force welling up within him. Within those hideous cracks, Geryon saw not flesh and blood and bone, but blazing energy. Tuchik began to glow brighter and brighter. He raised his hands imploringly.
"Help me!"
he screamed. He shrieked out a long, despairing,
"No!"
And then, with a shattering sound that was beyond noise, the disciple of Torak exploded into nothingness. Hurled to the floor by that awesome blast, Geryon tumbled against the wall. Without thinking, he caught the little boy, who was flung against him like a rag doll. The round stone clattered as it bounced against the rocks of the wall. Geryon reached out to catch it, but Aunt Paul's hand closed on his wrist.
"No," she said. "Do not touch it. It is the orb."
Geryon's hand froze. The little boy squirmed out of his grasp and ran after the rolling orb.
"Arand!"
He laughed triumphantly as he caught it. "What happened?" Silk muttered,
struggling to his feet and shaking his head.
"Tuchik destroyed himself,"
and Paul replied, also rising.
"He tried to unmake the orb. The Mother of the Gods will not permit unmaking."
She looked quickly at Geryon.
"Help me with your grandfather."
Belgarath had been standing almost in the center of the explosion that had destroyed Tuchik. The blast had thrown him halfway across the room, and he lay in a stunned heap, his eyes glazed and his hair and beard singed.
"Get up, father,"
Aunt Paul said urgently, bending over him. The turret began to shudder, and the basalt pinnacle from which it hung swayed. A vast booming sound echoed up out of the earth. Bits of rock and mortar showered down from the walls of the room as the earth quivered in the aftershock of Tuchik's destruction. In the rooms below, the stout door banged open and Geryon heard pounding feet.
"Where are you?"
Barak's voice bellowed.
"Up here!"
Silk shouted down the stairway. Barak and Mandaralan rushed up the stone stairs.
"Get out of here!"
Barak roared at them.
"The turret's starting to break away from the rock. The gimbal up there is collapsing. There's a crack 2 feet wide in the ceiling where the turret joins the rock."
"Father,"
Aunt Paul said sharply,
"you must get up."
Belgarath stared at her uncomprehendingly.
"Pick him up,"
she snapped at Barak. There was a dreadful tearing sound as the rocks that held the turret against the side of the peak began to rip away under the pressures of the convulsing earth.
"There,"
Relg said in a ringing voice. He was pointing at the back wall of the turret where the stones were cracking and shattering.
"Can you open it? There's a cave beyond."
Aunt Paul looked up quickly, focused her eyes on the wall, and pointed one finger.
"Burst!"
she commanded. The stone wall blew back into the echoing cave like a wall of straw struck by a hurricane.
"It is pulling loose,"
Silk yelled, his voice becoming shrill. He pointed as a widening crack between the turret and the solid face of the peak opened further.
"Jump!"
Barak shouted.
"Hurry!"
Silk flung himself across the crack and spun to catch Relg, who had followed him blindly. Durnik and Mandaralan, with Aunt Paul between them, leaped across as the groaning crack yawned wider.
"Go, boy!"
Barak commanded Geryon. Carrying the still dazed Belgarath, the big Kerak was lumbering toward the opening.
"The child!"
The voice in Geryon's mind crackled, no longer dry or disinterested.
"Save the child, or everything that has ever happened is meaningless."
Geryon gasped, suddenly remembering the little boy. He turned and ran back into the slowly toppling turret. He swept up the boy in his arms and ran toward the hole Aunt Paul had blown in the rock. Barak jumped across, and his feet scrambled for an awful second on the very edge of the far side. Even as he ran, Geryon pulled in his strength. At the instant he jumped, he pushed back with every ounce of his will. With the little boy in his arms, he literally flew across the awful gap and crashed directly into Barak's broad back. The little boy in his arms, with the orb of Aldur cradled protectively against his chest, smiled up at him.
"Arand?"
he asked. Geryon turned. The turret was leaning far out from the basalt wall, its supporting stones cracking, ripping away from the sheer face. Ponderously, it toppled outward. And then, with the shards and fragments of the Temple of Torak hurtling past it, it sheared free of the wall and fell into the awful gulf beneath. The floor of the cave they had entered was heaving as the earth shuddered and shock after shock reverberated up through the basalt pinnacle. Huge chunks of the walls of Rakhthal were ripping free, plunging past the cave mouth, flickering down through the red light of the newly risen sun.
"Is everybody here?"
Silk demanded, looking quickly around. Then, satisfied that they were all safe, he added,
"We had better get back from the opening a bit. This part of the peak does not feel all that stable."
"Do you want to go down now?"
Relg asked Aunt Paul.
"Or do you want to wait until this shaking subsides?"
"We had better move,"
Barak advised.
"These caves will be swarming with Murgos as soon as this quake stops."
Aunt Paul glanced at the half-conscious Belgarath, and then seemed to gather herself.
"We'll go down," she decided firmly. "We still have to stop to pick up the slave woman."
"She's almost certain to be dead,"
Relg asserted quickly.
"The earthquake's probably brought the roof of that cave down on her."
Aunt Paul's eyes were flinty as she looked him full in the face. No man alive could face that gaze for long. Relg dropped his eyes.
All right, he said sullenly.
He turned and led them back into the dark cave, with the earthquake rumbling beneath their feet. Here ends Book 3 of the Belgariad. Book 4, Castle of Wizardry, brings Geryon and Synedra to the first realization of their heritage as the prophecy moves them toward its fulfillment, and Geryon discovers there are powers more difficult than sorcery. This novel is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or have been used fictitiously. Any resemblance to actual events, locales, or persons living or dead is entirely coincidental. From Books in Motion in Spokane, Washington, this is Cameron Byerly. Thank you for listening.